Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Over the last few months, we've brought you some really interesting people, and today I have with me Suman Bose. Suman, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
It's so nice to have you here. Suman is from XLRI. He's from Harvard Business School. He's been to INSEAD. He's worked for Siemens, Hewlett-Packard, Dassault, and is advisor to several boards and to CEOs. Suman, your profile speaks of four characteristics, and these are leadership, technology, philanthropy, and social entrepreneurship. And I'm going to ask you about each of these separately. But before we get into these, you worked for three major companies. Talk to us a little bit about your early journey.
Well, I think the best part of the early journey was that it was never planned.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I was not in a rush to prove a point either to myself or to anybody around me to say that, oh, this is how you measure success. So whatever looked exciting, whatever looks interesting, jumped into it, and that serendipity continued. So what essentially ended up happening was, although I worked for big companies, I would typically be assigned or pick up opportunities which were kind of the back of beyond opportunities. You know, no one wanted to do it. It was not the most exciting thing happening, apparently, and not the biggest the jobs which were under limelights. So the so-called, the real corporate guys didn't want those jobs because they were kind of, so for example, you know, Asia Pacific, when I got into the industry of technology, the largest so-called Indian tech company at that point of time was actually below 100 crores.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've seen the diskless PCs. I've seen the 128 KB floppy drives, which was like, wow, you know, 128 KB. You know, when you could write so much of software programs, and so that's how it happened. Right. You know, I don't think it was I ever turning back, and I could figure out that very little that I had really planned. In fact, whenever I really started or I had a chance of planning my career within mm-hmm. one of these companies, you know, because they were longest end, so it kind of meandered through these companies, I've realized that you know, the bias of making a choice based on half-known facts and other influences actually made the choice pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Just to understand, you know, after an MBA, decided to go into technology, and you stayed with technology.
Actually, it was engineering.
Sorry?
After my engineering, uh-huh.
And then you went to XLRI and to Harvard.
So I worked for a few okay. years, uh-huh. between about 4 years in between, and that's when, you know, went into tech.
Hmm.
And after MBA, had a typical choice. The glamorous jobs those days were either you did banking,
yeah.
consulting, or you went to, and day one, you know, there was this huge pressure to be yeah. in day one.
Yeah.
So I got day one placed, but then I really looked at it and said, really, do I want to do this?
Mm.
And maybe I got too influenced by that book, which was doing rounds over there, which was, you know, Apple, Pepsi
yeah.
to Apple.
Yeah.
And Scully saying, you know, Jobs asking him that, do you all want to sell sugared water all your life? And mm. I said, do you want to sell soap all my life? Or do you want to sell, you know, some
correct.
Banking stuff all my life? Yeah. And so the excitement of being in tech when not many people were looking at tech
yeah.
was fascinating.
So in your last role in Siemens, what exactly were some of your challenges as the CEO and MD?
So I think when you work for these large companies, 50% of the challenge is internal
hmm.
and internal communication. Especially when you come into countries like India, there are these urban legends about, you know, oh, you know, this is how it happens.
Yeah.
This is never possible over there. These are the products which we'll never bring into those kind of countries because, you know, this is not a M1 market. You know, innovation is all done at the headquarters.
Yeah.
And these racial biases do come. They are, and I've seen, for example,
mm.
India headquartered companies also have the racial bias mm. against non-Indians. So I'm not saying that it's against Indians or...
Sure.
So it's general, you know, that, you know, not invented here attitude of yeah. large companies. And the larger the company, the larger the challenges. So you deconstruct it, you create opportunities, and then you start focusing on one win. And in that, doing that one win, it's important sometimes to let go of quite a few. So that prioritization as an executive, and I strongly believe that prioritization is the key.
Correct. So you know, you have spent large part of your working life as a professional, and yet you say that your career has been characterized by growth and entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Help me to understand this dilemma in my mind of how a person who spent so much time with as a professional in multinationals is so entrepreneurial in nature.
As I told you, you know, I think I used to think I'm a misfit in a large company, but I think this is what a large company has to become in the future. Mm. And maybe if I had a chance of doing it all over the last 25, 30 years, I would possibly double down on the fact that you need these corporate entrepreneurs internally.
Okay.
Otherwise, the pipeline of innovation is dry.
Yeah.
The only way you innovate is you buy assets outside. You buy companies outside. There is a 80-90% casualty rate of integration. So most of the time, your balance sheet, you write off of these companies after a few years, you write down these companies, the integration never happens, it never trickles down. So this innovation culture, which is coexistent with entrepreneurship, is something that is most important.
Mm.
And I was lucky to have had even people that that allowed me. Maybe it was their naivety and mine. to have both been drinking the same Kool-Aid.
It's very interesting, because it takes me back years and years ago when I joined ITC.
Yeah.
The first Indian chairman of ITC was Mr. Ajit Haksar.
Yeah.
And he had coined this word called pronorian, which was professional entrepreneurs, which is what he wanted ITC managers to be. And you're saying exactly the same thing.
Yes. Hewlett-Packard, for example, I was fortunate to have worked in HP when the founders had left the company, but they were still pretty much alive. And I remember there was one of these early days of my career. We were sitting in an auditorium in Palo Alto, and both Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett was on the stage. Both were in advanced stage. Bill Hewlett was in advanced stages of dementia. He could hardly speak. He was drooling. And somebody in the audience asked him Bill, what was your business plan when you started HP? So Bill looks at Dave and says, very strugglingly, he says, Dave, did we have a business plan? And Dave looks all around and says, in a very long drawl, he says, no.
Yeah.
And I think that spirit was there. So the HP that I came on from, the initial days of that HP, was being number one, two was not the goal. The goal was to get the best products with our customers. And you know, that customer centricity of an entrepreneur, that I have to own this customer. And so the biggest of the customers of our competitors would still swear by HP because that product that we shipped to them. And everything was like, there were these legends that were built around. And I think those were the cultures. So I for example, the second part of entrepreneurship is, I learned in HP is that you don't call for a meeting in your office.
Mm.
You walk into
someone else's
yes. office to do the meeting, especially yeah. if you were the senior guy.
Correct.
You know, that management by walking around. I think these are the one which fostered entrepreneurship.
Wonderful. And, you know, you just spoke about customer centricity, which used to be there and is still there. But how do you think technology and automation, and now we're talking of robotics, how do you think customer centricity will be retained by so many companies? Because machines cannot be empathetic, you know, have any kind of empathy.
Yes, but see, machines also don't get fatigued. If you call up a call center at 3 o'clock in the morning, and a human takes that call, and that human has done a 12-hour shift that day, you know, the human is tired. The machine is not. So I think what will happen is a few things. One is a machine would be able to. I'm a great believer that you will never. So the pendulum is swinging. So it swung from all people to now people are saying it will be all machines and all humans will become jobless and all they will do is play video games all their day.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that will happen. What will happen is bulk of the boring jobs, and that's what technology has always done, the bulk of the boring jobs bulk of the non-value-added jobs, bulk of the first categorization, understanding from your caller ID who you are, understanding from the place that you're calling, what you could be calling in for at that hour, and then giving that human a script which allows the human, even whether it is at 8 o'clock in the morning or it's 8 o'clock in the night, to go through a script and give you at least a certain level of service, a certain level of information is available for the human to react to you. And I think that will actually increase customer centricity. However, saying this, the culture of that company is what will matter. When everybody says, we are customer centric, very few companies are. And most importantly, very few managers on their task says, the customer comes first. And whatever it takes, it has to be with the customer around us, because that's a guy who's or a girl who's paying our bills. That's the culture. No machine can do it, no humans can do it.
You're so right.
It's the tone at the top.
I've written about this. Companies that have a customer service department
cannot have
customer service. It has to be across the whole company and not in a department.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So for example, and with me, I know the most important thing was that I would not allow an employee to be ever, you know, if it's an issue of performance, I've done a lot of separations with dignity. A customer has to be handled with dignity, an employee has to be handled with dignity. And that dignity is what you, and your partners have to handle with dignity. There can be always differences, but when you build that tone at the top and you make it everybody's business, and not just an HR department's business to do employee management, but everybody's job at the top. And I think that's what's going to differentiate companies tomorrow. And I personally believe that technology will aid, but the role of the human will not go away, because it's the human who scripts the tone.
Very interesting. So moving on, Suman, you know, talking about the first part of your four characteristics, which is leadership. You say your core competency is unearthing new opportunities and driving outstanding leadership growth. Help me to understand, what is the process in this?
So the process is, you know, you just take a look at a simple 2x2 matrix. You know, new business, existing business, new customers, existing customers, new customers. As the companies grow larger and larger, 70, 80, 90% of their business comes from existing space. That is why you put in your forecasting model, your CRM models, you do your heuristics, you know, deals moving front, back, product line, pipeline, all of that happens. That's great. So what is the job of the CEO? To go and play golf?
And handle not a bad exceptions? Idea, but yes, I agree.
Somehow I haven't been able to pick that up. I still have a lot of action sports that I do.
Yeah.
So I think the job of the leader is to take that new space. And to do the new space, while you create structures and processes to manage your existing turf, just look from business perspective, you know, how do you cross-sell, how do you extend lines, products, and all of that. The new space is the entrepreneurial space. A leader does it, but he does it along with a team. And that's where you also start selecting your next level of entrepreneurs in your organization. So I, for example, have always believed that that space should at least be, under my watch, at least be 10 to 15% of our business, but growing like 3 times or 5 times faster than the piece which is existing. And that then starts keeping the organization excited.
True.
That's make them the best of the organization guy says, hey, you know what? I also want to do a little bit of that in my space. Extend that a little bit more with my existing customer. Talk about what else I can do for the customer. Do customer-centric innovations. Customers would tell you, you know, I'm also looking for this. Can you extend yourself to do that? And I think it does a few things. It does, of course, it's good for business because you do huge high growth. And because you're a leader, you're also, if things fail, it fails, you're directly responsible.
Yeah.
You don't do blame-mongering, pass on the blame to somebody. But on the other hand, what you do is you're also setting the tone that guy's failing is okay, but we will overall as a portfolio will win more than we are failing. And it starts also bringing out the entrepreneurs or your professional entrepreneurs that you use the word to term in ITC. It brings them up, bubbles them up.
Fascinating. And you also mentioned that you believe in the infinite capacity of humans with the right attitude.
Yeah.
I'm just quoting from your own words. talk to us a little bit about first, what is infinite capacity, and second is what is the right attitude?
I think there's no never ever I have felt that there was a bad person from a competence perspective. It could be a person was not motivated to do their job. Many of us end up taking up jobs, taking up assignments which we realize our heart is not there, and that should be understood as quickly as possible, and changes should be done, even if it means separation. You know, you may not have any other role for an employee or you move into somebody else. But inherently, it's about finding that the true value of that individual. Now, if you approach it the classical way, management tells you, oh, you know, you do your bell curve fitting and these guys are not good, these guys are great, these are God's gift to mankind. That's not true.
Yeah.
That guy also makes errors. But in that context, so what you're doing is you're doing context sensitivity. But the context sensitivity, when you do with this belief that all of them are actually stars, you know, you don't put in a bell curve in a football team and say, you know, I'll have Six Sigma of the guys who play great football, and or you know, in a team of surgeon, you know, imagine you walked into a hospital and say, you know, I got the other side of the bell curve guy to do a surgery on me.
Yes.
Or a guy who's 99.9% correct, but by the way, I'm his the other 0.01%.
Correct.
It doesn't work that way.
I agree.
So you have to believe that everyone, and that's again the belief tone. You have to believe that everyone. So I have fought tooth and nail with my management many a times to say, I don't have anybody below 4.
Mm.
Or sometimes I have fought tooth and nail saying, I don't have anybody above 3 at this point of time, not because these guys are bad, but because they need to be groomed to move to that level of 4 and 5.
Correct.
And I think that's possible.
Correct. So what you're really saying is that there aren't bad employees, there aren't bad companies, but there could be bad bosses.
Oh, of course. Of course. And that's the reason I really believe that, you know, I'm a great believer of this whole servant leadership concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the organization chart gets drawn the wrong way. It has to be the other way.
Correct.
The glory, the sunlight has to be the guys who are really at the bottom, in the so-called organization chart,
yeah,
who are toiling the day, who are making it happen.
Yeah.
They leave, the organization dies. The CEO leaves, the CEO gets fired, nothing happens.
Absolutely right.
You know, the king is dead, and long live the new king.
Absolutely right. Right. So, you know, you worked with people across multiple countries. What has been your experience of working with people in India and outside in terms of culture?
Can get very context sensitive. Well, first of all, I think the first thing that strikes to me is, for example, in Europe, Europeans are very, very open. They would not mince words. They would give you a straight feedback. Americans, depending upon which part of US you're talking about, West Coast has a distinctly different culture than the East and then the South.
Yeah.
India, I think the biggest challenge for us is a lot of growth in the recent times has happened without the growth of adequate management systems. A lot of our management systems are imported management systems where people have learned it other places, schools, etc. We brought it in, it's still not cultural sensitive. So you still see a lot of workplace friction.
Mm-hmm.
Only very few companies, like for example, the likes of ITCs or the Unilevers in India, etc., some of the very old ones, or the Tajes of the world, who have built a distinct culture where, you know, but in India, most of the time, for example, I've seen as classic example, you know, here comes the employee appraisal time. Every employee comes out of the appraisal feeling great, but when their results come in or when their hikes come in, they say, but why did you give me a 2?
Hmm.
The manager feels shy to tell that guy.
Absolutely, yes.
The feedbacks are also winded that at the end of the meeting, you don't even know whether you came or you went.
Correct.
And I think the first and foremost is the feedback giving and feedback taking as a culture. We need to do better.
Absolutely.
The second part of it is most Indian, and especially for multinational companies, there is this lot of playing to the cheer and playing to the crowd at the headquarters. I think it's changing, but it has to change faster because the market potential is so infinitely large that as a culture, we have to first believe. Again, the belief system should be there for us to believe what's possible and then gear ourselves to be able to deliver to those promises.
So that gives me an interesting segue into my next question. You spent so much all your time in technology. How is it different from, you know, in managing tech people as compared to non-tech people?
Nothing. No difference.
No difference at all?
No difference. In fact, I think it's about managing people with the people is the same, you know, the motivations. Different people have different motivations. You can't stereotype a tech guy to say, oh, you know, a tech guy is always like this. That's a stereotype. What typically happens is you have to manage the manage for exceptions, both ends.
Correct.
If there's a high performance end, manage that exception. If it's a very low performance end, manage the exception. Get away from the mainstream. If it's working fine, get away and don't try to take and claim. And then most importantly is believe in the fact that every day is a new day. Mm-hmm. There is no single repetitive day. Mm-hmm. There's no boring day.
That's interesting. And you know, you also speak about disrupting technology. Give me an example of when you were involved in a disruptive technology.
First of all, I think technology is a kind of a singularity. Mm-hmm. Every technology, you know, and that technology could be the classic example I have is, you know, you're very hungry, standing below a tree, there are fruits, you pluck them, and then finally these fruits are done. Mm-hmm. And then you realize that if you just went back, the tree has a lot of fruit still left over there. All you need is a ladder. But that ladder is the technology.
Correct.
It doesn't have to be a big robotic arm going and plucking the tree.
Yeah.
So it has to be the horses for the courses. And it has to be something that must have a human face. The word disruptive is actually an oxymoron because it kind of creates a figure that enough of a storm or of a cloud coming in is disruptive, it's dark. Mm. Actually, it's not.
Correct.
And therefore, one has to be able to, and especially again, these are the leadership responsibilities, take away things which are dark and ensure, it's like as a parent, what you do to your children.
Sure.
You expose them. It's not by saying that don't do this, you're safeguarding them because that curiosity will kill the cat. But you expose them, but tell them what is dark. And tell them that you will figure out, there will be days when you will burn your fingers.
Absolutely.
But come back, I have burn all. I'll give you, put it in on your fingers and you'll be all right.
Yeah.
So that safety, security with technology and how you manage through disruption. So I'll give you a simple example. For example, my mom, is a very newcomer to smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
And all she does today is she plays around with it and she has discovered so many things
mm-hmm.
with it that even I don't apply and use.
True.
So I think that's the beauty of technology seeping in our lives
mm-hmm.
and becoming a part of our fabric.
It's very interesting, you know, I like this perspective because what you're saying is disruption happens from the technological perspective, but more importantly, disruption happens from the customer's perspective.
Absolutely.
Because it's the customer or how he or she decides to use that technology is what disrupts their lifestyle.
Simple thing is, you know, I used to spend at least 60-70% of my time with the customer. I hate board meetings. I hate sitting down in an office and looking through Excel sheets. You know, if Excel did all the problem solving, then guys were not needed.
Correct.
But when you sit with the customer, the first thing you go and say is, how are you using your product?
Yeah.
Just go and see how the customer is using your product. You will find 15 different ways the customer is using it, which you or your product team has never thought about.
True.
The customer has figured out things. Learn that. Sometimes I have been shameless. I said, can I learn? Can I send some more people, understand a little better, so that maybe I can deliver similar value to some other customers? Or give you an enhancement of value.
Yeah.
And I think that has always worked.
Very, very nice. So now moving to the third part, which is on philanthropy. You have mentioned that you support a school for underprivileged children in the Himalayas. Talk to us a little bit about this.
Well, this is something I think I'm really
passionate about.
And it has kind of changed the course of what I'm doing today. So I kind of can say that I stumbled into this school. I have lots of dogs, so I realized that, you know, bring them up in Gurgaon was tough. So
yeah.
I took this place, rented this place in the foothills of Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was while walking them out and into the jungles, I found this school, which was fascinating. Started by a gentleman post his retirement from his, he was an economist. He's a Tamilian who worked across the world, based out of Bombay, retired, and his kids all, you know, the typical empty nest now, the top schools, all settled, well settled globally, So he and his wife decides to go into the Himalayas and live there. And one thing leads to another. They set up this school. It's a 20-year-old school. It's about has about 650 students. By design, 2/3 of the kids are girls, and they come from abject poverty. I mean, you know, it's not just about they're coming from poor family. They come from abject poverty, destitutes. And now the kids are coming out. They're becoming doctors. They're becoming engineers. Right. They're becoming and so every year, for example, there are a couple of kids which gets scholarships to go and study in the US. But the interesting thing is, they're giving it back. The kids are coming back. They're working back with their society. One kid does something great, the entire village changes. The face of the village changes. So we are now turning the school into a completely residential school because the grades are, you know, because they don't have a place to go and study back at home. This school has 280 working days, which is unheard of.
Amazing, yeah.
And we are trying to take it to maybe about close to 300. The kids come at 7 o'clock in the morning. They get all their day's food. They get all everything, their clothes, their books, their everything. It's all free. But that's not the point. The point is, that's possibly the only, and they leave at 4:35. And when I asked the founder, why is the school timing so long? He says, because they have nothing else to do when they go back.
Correct.
And this is all the food that they get. So many of these kids don't get any more food when they go back home. So we're trying to build the hostels for them and all of that stuff. It's been a fascinating journey. But the most interesting thing is, you see the potential of these kids. You know, during the school day, annual day, the science exams, artifacts that these kids put up, the kind of stuff that I've seen over there, kind of innovation I've seen over there, they started doing tinkering labs even before, you know, government of India started talking about the tinkering labs, etc. The kind of stuff that I've saw these kids doing is really amazing. I've taken my friends from Europe and US over there, and they said, you know, we wish that our schools had this. Some of the so-called great countries where education is lauded. We are starting to get every year a couple of students from the Ivy Leagues who come in and spend 6 months at the school to do this social integration.
Fascinating
stuff. And look at this man, you know, one man, a determination of a man.
Yeah.
And by the way, we don't have any big donors. Every year we start pretty much with a slate zero. So I'll give you a funny anecdote. So I said, so how do you do it, sir? You know, you raise about $1.5 million every year. He said, oh, I go and pray to the Lord. I said, who's the Lord? I thought, he said, Lord Balaji. And every year when it happens, when we meet the target, I go and pay a homage to Lord Balaji at Tirupati and say, Lord, I'll come back again next year. So I have a great relationship with the Lord.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, more power to you. I mean, I think, you know, education is something which is going to change our country. And you're so deeply involved in it. Fantastic.
And the world.
And the world, of course.
Yeah, because there's a real balancing of even the countries so-called where we call them educated are not finding skilled. So I think this definition of what is education and what is skill is going to do the rebalance. And technology will play a very large role. Destructive role, but also a very positive role that can be played with technology to make that change happen.
So moving on to the last few questions. You've had such an amazing career. You're doing such great work now. What is the secret of your success?
I don't know whether I would really call myself a success, and maybe that's a secret.
Mm-hmm.
So I forever stay hungry. And I really mean that. You know, I have in me an ability to go in and jive with teenagers to understand what's happening, what's new happening, etc. And that keeps you very humble, very grounded, because you realize how much you don't know. And how much you have to do more. And sometimes doing less is doing more. Because sometimes when you are very cocksure about yourself, you go and do things which are wrong. And by doing it more, you're doing more wrong. So sometimes you have to do less, you have to push yourself back.
Correct.
And I think that's what has always worked for me. I don't know whether you call it success. Because what's the measure for success? You know, these are all philosophical questions.
It's also all in the mind.
Yeah, so working for a big company, is it a measure of success? I don't know. I don't think so.
Sure.
Today, looking back, I think I should have done more to do what I'm doing now, maybe 10 years back when I was even younger. So,
wonderful.
keeping yourself hungry and bullish.
I agree with you. A question that I ask all my guests, what is your biggest learning from your biggest failure?
The human frailty.
Okay.
And the biggest failure actually typically if you see would happen, I don't know for you, but for me, after the so-called the best period, because that's the time when as a human, you take your eye off the ball, you get a little too cocky, you think everything is working fine, and bam, a failure happens. Mm. So I think it just kind of tells you how frail we humans are, and how much are things out there which we don't know.
Yeah.
Can you avoid failures in the future? People are learning from the failure. Yeah, don't make the same mistake. That's what I tell my daughter. Knows. Sure. Let's share our failures so that I don't repeat your mistakes, you don't repeat my mistakes. But you'll fail again. But the most important thing is if you're humble about it, you don't punish yourself, you don't punish others. You pick up your broken pieces, clean the plate, and move on. And sometimes you move on with a heavy heart, but nevertheless you have to move on. And being humble. Actually, because if you're not humble, if you are, you know, so-called that strong guy who's failed, then you'll become brittle. Mm. If you are humble, then you're like a thing that's bent and it has the ability to spring back.
Correct.
I think that's been my learning.
Very, very well said. So my last question to you, with all your experience, and you must have dealt with hundreds of young managers, and I'm sure you've dealt with lots of startups. What would your advice be to a young person starting off in life?
I think first and foremost, I think, there's a famous statement of Mao Zedong, which says that 50% of the sky is held up by women. I think we need to see more, and this is not just India, across the world.
I'm with you.
We need to see more women coming in. Women leaders, they start brilliant. I know my undergraduate, the batch topper was a girl. In Excel, the batch topper was a girl. In Harvard, the batch topper was a girl. So all of them were girls. But what happens? Why only 7% of them make to the boardrooms? So I think that's a message. Don't give up. This is a stereotype that women don't like math. Some of the best guys or the girls, the persons I've seen, are girls who love math. So don't get into stereotypes. Don't get into listen to, be patient. There is a lot of advice. A lot of them are good advice. Listen to them. But what you do, what you adopt is yours. Your life is yours. No one has put in the feet into the same water twice in a moving, in a flowing river. So you will have to have your share of experiences, good, bad, ugly. Take them in the stride, come back, be humble about it. And believe me, I think the whole human evolution is all about trying and making it happen. There was somebody who decided to try and make it happen, and that changed the course for the others. You have a choice. What do you want to do? There's no harm if you decide not to be the leader. No harm. Not everybody has to be the leader, but there's no harm if you want to go out, try, fail a few times, do it again, and don't get stuck to a stereotype of, oh, this is a job that I want to do. This is a kind of career I want to have. This is a girl that I want to marry, a boy that I want to marry. This is the kind of house I want to live in. They'll go away.
Suman, thank you very much. The thousands and thousands of people who listen to our podcast every day. And I'm sure all your words of wisdom and your experience sharing will be of tremendous value. Thank you again for coming to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.